Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our call today. This discussion is designed to be an opportunity for IJ's most generous supporters to learn about a very important aspect of IJ's overall legal strategy, and that is our advocacy at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm pleased to introduce Scott Bullock, IJ's President and General Counsel, who will be hosting our conversation, and our very special guests, IJ Senior Attorneys Bob McNamara and Rob Johnson. Scott, Bob, and Rob will also welcome the opportunity to answer questions from listeners. So if you have a question for them, just press star on your phone and we will get to some Q&A toward the end of the call. Scott, maybe you can start things off with a bit of context for the conversation. As most of our listeners know, the U.S. Supreme Court takes very few cases each year. The justices receive 7,000 to 8,000 petitions for review each term, but agree to hear only about 80 cases. What does IJ do to increase the likelihood that our cases will be among those 80?
You're absolutely right. The Supreme Court only takes on a very small fraction of the cases that people appeal to them. And even though the number of cases in court keeps increasing, the number of appeals that the Supreme Court hears has actually gone down in recent years. So it is increasingly challenging to get the court to take up a case. And the two most common ways that the court takes up an issue or a case is when there is a split of opinion among various courts. And then also the court will weigh in on issues of national importance. Those are the two most likely scenarios where the court will agree to hear a case. So with those in mind, what IJ does is that we oftentimes take on multiple cases on particular issues that are related to our mission. An example of that, the Supreme Court has never definitively weighed in on whether or not economic protectionism is a legitimate government interest. Some courts have said that it is. Other courts have said that it is not. This is an issue that we routinely raise in our economic liberty cases, and it's an issue that we want to bring before the Supreme Court, where we're confident that they will rule that economic protectionism is not legitimate. The other thing that we do to raise the profile of the issue and then the national importance of it is to talk about why the cases are so important. So we're litigating not just in the courts of law, but the court of public opinion as well, and using all the tools of public interest law to bring these issues to national attention and hopefully to the attention of the Supreme Court. So we've had five cases directly before the Supreme Court in all four of our mission areas. And then in just the past two terms, we've had two cases, one involving school choice and another case involving free speech, where the court granted our petition, vacated an adverse decision below, and then sent the case back down to the lower courts. So we are active in all of our pillar areas before the Supreme Court, and probably our most famous case before the Supreme Court, the Kelo case, was a classic example, the only case that we technically lost, but was a classic example of using the tools of public interest law, of how you can take even a setback in court and turn it into a win for liberty, where the backlash led to so many changes in the law that benefited property owners nationwide. So I wanted to talk now and turn to the rest of the panel for the discussion on some of the specific work that we're doing before the Supreme Court this term. And joining us, as Melanie mentioned, is Rob Johnson. And Rob, before he started litigating at the Supreme Court, was actually a clerk for Justice Kennedy. And so I wondered, Rob, if you could just start off by talking a little bit what it's like at, this is the first week of the Supreme Court's term, so what it's like at the court at the start of the term and what the court is doing right now.
Well, you know, it's obviously an exciting time to be at the court. Right now, the justices are all coming back. Most of them have been in Europe for the entire summer, with the exception of Justice Thomas, who instead takes his RV and tours around the country. He's the idiosyncratic one, but they're all back from their summer vacations. They have their new round of clerks, so they're sort of getting to know everybody. They're also obviously having argument. Today was the second day of argument at the Supreme Court. But really the most important work that's going on this time of year is going on behind the scenes, and that involves the work of deciding what cases the Supreme Court is going to take to make up its docket for the year. Because as the justices are all gallivanting around the world during the summer, they are not actually meeting to decide on pending cert petitions. Instead, they are basically saving them all up like squirrels. And then they come back and they have a huge list of thousands of cases. And they have what's called the long conference, where they get together and they go through all of those petitions and they vote, is this one we're going to take or not? And then at the end of that, they produce this enormous orders list that goes on for 70 pages. And that really is where you find out a large chunk of the Supreme Court's docket. And we're going to be getting grants from that any day now. It's something that will be, you know, very interesting to see. And then in that process, I think it's an interesting question. What are they looking for? What are the sort of factors that they are taking into consideration? And, you know, Scott obviously mentioned the presence of a split, the issue of national importance. But the other sort of thing that's going through their heads is, I think, an intangible factor, which is something that I think IJ really excels at, which is that judges, justices are human beings in addition to being legal robots wearing a robe. And so when they're looking at a case, they really are influenced by the fact, you know, do you have a sympathetic plaintiff? Is this a case where you have a sympathetic story? And that really can make a difference. I think you see that in the Kelo case where, you know, there was certainly an argument that there was a split. There, you know, technically we had a good argument that there was, but it wasn't crystal clear. But what was really amazing about that case was the human story. And I think that's why the court ultimately took the case.
Justices are humans, too. That's right. Yeah. So thanks, Rob. So with that background in mind, let's turn to a petition that IJ has pending before the Supreme Court this term. And we asked the court to hear an eminent domain case out of Louisiana that involves dirt.
Yes.
Or more specifically, dirt farming. And Bob, why don't you tell folks about this case and why we're involved in it?
Oh, one of the many joys of working at IJ is I get to learn about things like dirt farming. This is a case out of the Louisiana Supreme Court. It's an eminent domain case, like Kelo, but unlike Kelo and unlike a lot of the eminent domain cases that really get a lot of attention, rightly so, this isn't about whether the government can take someone's property, but this is about the other side of the coin of eminent domain, which is how much the government has to pay in compensation when it takes property. It's simply the fact of the matter that nationwide, governments are massively undercompensating property owners, and especially small businesses, when they take their property. And the fact that they can pay less than they would have to pay in a voluntary transaction really explains why we're seeing so much use and abuse of eminent domain, because the government can essentially force people to give up their land for less than it's worth. And the case itself is, I think, a good example of what Rob was talking about, which is that you really need compelling facts. You need a case that's fun to talk about, and that's why we have a dirt farm case. It's a case that was litigated actually by friends of IJ all the way up to Louisiana Supreme Court, and we've managed to bring the resources to bear to take it to the next level, and we're representing Chad Giroux, who is a dirt farmer in Louisiana, and the way you farm dirt, he's literally a dirt manufacturer. He cuts these holes in his land down deep down in the bayou of Louisiana. It's Louisiana, so they flood, and he drains them, and they flood, and he drains them. And then once he finally has dry land, he churns it endlessly for weeks on end to create this fine-grained sandy dirt that's really useful in construction projects. It was a great business for Chad. He was very successful for a decade until the local levee district took his land for the purpose of actually mining the same dirt to use to build levees. Now, a levee is a public use. You're allowed to take land to build a levee to benefit the entire public. But the problem is that when the case went to trial, the judge found that land in Chad's area wasn't very valuable. The land they took was worth about $10,000. But Chad's dirt farming business that was disrupted by the taking, and he actually had to let contracts fall through that he'd already signed, his business was very valuable. And the court found that he suffered about $150,000 in business damages directly because of the taking. When the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court, when it got to the Louisiana Supreme Court, the Louisiana Supreme Court said the only thing you're entitled to when the government takes your land is just the fair market value of the acreage they took. Whatever damage happened to your business, you just have to lump. And there is a split of authority on this issue. It's definitely worth hearing. We're actually in the midst of briefing it right now. The government has ordered, the Supreme Court has ordered the state of Louisiana to respond, and you're getting kind of up-to-the-minute updates here. Just before I came in here, I was working on our final brief in the case. I'll go back to working on it when we're done with this phone call, but we expect the court to have a conference discussing the petition at the end of this month. And it's always a long shot to get the court to hear anything, especially these days, but we have compelling facts, and it is definitely an issue of just vital importance that people have been saying for years the court's going to have to resolve, and we're giving them the chance.
Yeah, it's just a great opportunity where we seized an opportunity here, because most of the time we're working on cases that we're litigating in the lower courts and trying to bring up before the Supreme Court on our own. But this was an example of a case that we were able to take on, even though it was litigated by others, because the issue was so important. And oftentimes these cases and appeals would not be brought if it wasn't for a group like IJ to step in and cover the costs of it and make sure these issues are heard. So we're obviously working to bring cases like the Dirk case and others up before the court, but we also occasionally submit amicus briefs or friends of the amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs in other people's cases. And Bob, could you talk a little bit about what considerations we have in choosing whether or not to file amicus briefs, and what are some of the hallmarks of the cases that we might get involved with in amicus?
Absolutely. So I think the watchword is that we do relatively few amicus briefs. You see a lot of shops where the urge is just to get involved in any case that's high profile so that you can say you were involved. And it doesn't really matter what you say to the court or whether the court finds your brief useful, you just want to say you were involved. That's not what we do, and we actually have a bias against filing amicus briefs. If we're going to file an amicus brief, we need two things at minimum. One is a direct nexus to an issue IJ is actually litigating. We always have a plan and an explanation for we're doing this so because we want the court to say that, and we're going to use that in the following way in our actual cases. There's always a direct payoff we want, and there's always something specific that we want to say. As I say, it's common to have people just file briefs that say this side should win or that side should win, and then they can kind of trumpet that my chosen side won. We are much more targeted. It's not unusual for IJ to file a brief that's not aimed at the court, but is literally aimed at a specific chambers. We want Justice Alito's clerks to know about this, or Justice Kennedy's clerks to know about that. We have a unique perspective we're bringing where we have a narrower doctrinal goal that we're trying to achieve that we then have a concrete plan to put into action once we achieve it.
Well, with those criteria that we routinely use in mind, let's talk a little bit about the amicus briefs that we filed this term, at least so far, before the court, and there have been two. One has to do with Fourth Amendment rights and its impact on our work in civil forfeiture. And another has to do with free speech. So turning back to you, Rob, why don't we talk, you talk a little bit about the Carpenter case and why we did a brief in that Fourth Amendment case.
So this is an important Fourth Amendment case involving the question about your right to privacy and records involving your cell phone and specifically cell phone location data. And so it turns out that the cell phone that you're carrying around in your pocket with you every day is not just passively sitting in your pocket. It's actually pinging cell phone towers everywhere that you go. And this is creating a record that is kept by the phone company of every tower that has been pinged. And this is happening regularly throughout the day. And by accessing this data for the towers that have been pinged and by what phones, police can, in theory, get a record of essentially where anybody with a cell phone is at any given time, and they can do that going back because the phone companies are retaining this data. So there's essentially a log for everybody in America where they are all the time. And the question is, does the government have to get a warrant in order to obtain that information? Do they have to actually have probable cause of a crime, or can they get the information essentially for free under some sort of lower standard? And this is both an important question, obviously, because it involves a huge issue of privacy for Americans, but it's also important for another reason, because it involves a doctrinal construct that the court has called the third-party doctrine. And the idea of the third-party doctrine is essentially once you give your information to a third party, like a bank or the cell phone company, you don't own it anymore. and it becomes the property of this third party. And if the government wants it, they can get it without having to obtain a warrant. Now, that obviously has implications for your phone records, but it has implications for other kinds of data, too. And it actually increasingly has large implications in the Internet age where, you know, you think about your email account. Is that something you don't have privacy in because it's hosted on Google servers? So, you know, you can see the implications of this. So then the question becomes, well, why is IJ interested, and what do we have to say that is unique? And it turns out that this third-party doctrine is actually something that is implicated in our structuring cases, which are cases that we litigated in the context of civil forfeiture. And the IRS would go, and it was under the third-party doctrine, was basically trolling bank records on the theory that, you know, these are the records of the bank. They don't need a warrant. They were looking through bank records, looking for what they would deem a suspicious pattern of cash deposits. And then if they found that pattern, they would seize the entire bank account, and then they would force the owner of the account to litigate to get that money back. And often that process would take years. It was very expensive. And all of that was really made possible by the third-party doctrine, because without access to the bank records, they never would have initiated these cases in the first place. So we realized that the court was taking up this issue, and we thought, gosh, this is an issue where we have direct experience. We have something to contribute. And we can make a point that's really unique, because what the parties are saying in this case is they're trying to basically cabin off cell phones, and they're trying to not attack the third-party doctrine too broadly. And this is, you know, it makes sense. Often when you're a litigant in the court, you want to advance the narrowest possible rule that you can under which you can win, and sort of like don't bite off more than you can chew, right? But from our perspective, we really want to push the court in a broader direction. We want to say, look, you need to reconsider the third-party doctrine, not just for cell phones, but much more broadly, including even for bank records, because really, why is the government trolling through American bank records? The scope of the surveillance that we're talking about, millions of reports filed every year with the government about people's banking, is staggering and very troubling. So we wanted to bring the court's attention to the fact that, you know, not only is there a problem with the expansion of the doctrine, but its application in the past has raised serious issues as well.
That's great. And also the court, as Justice Thomas in his recent statement at the end of last term has indicated, increasing interest in the civil forfeiture issue. Clearly, several of the justices are troubled by civil forfeiture, and the more that we can bring that issue before them, the better. And of course, we are actively litigating a number of civil forfeiture cases with the goal of getting that issue once before the court, which it has not addressed in probably close to almost 20 years now. So Bob, why don't you talk a little bit about a case that perhaps many people on the call have at least heard of from the Supreme Court this year, called Masterpiece Cakes, and talk a little bit about IJ's involvement with that case.
Absolutely. So I think if you've read about only one case in front of the court this term, you've probably read about the Cake Shop case, which is a baker in Colorado who designs specialty wedding cakes, and a gay couple came into his shop and asked him to make a cake for their wedding, and he refused, and he's been cited under Colorado's non-discrimination law. And this is really, I think, a classic example of what IJ brings to the table in our Supreme Court practice and our amicus brief practice. This case has drawn innumerable amicus briefs on both sides, and a lot of them can be summed up as either gay rights are important or religious liberty is important. And it's not that either of those statements is false, but they're not surprising statements. They're not adding much to the debate. But what we noticed is in the lower court opinion, upholding the sanctions against the baker, the court said one of the reasons it was ruling against the baker is that the baker was selling his cakes instead of giving them away for free, and so it gave him less First Amendment protection. And that's tremendously dangerous for Americans and for IJ, where we care a lot and litigate a lot about occupational speech, about people who speak for a living. And so really, our brief is designed to warn the court, especially the members of the court who care about this, that the lower court opinion is kind of a Trojan horse. It has snuck this idea in a way you might miss if you're focused on the hot-button headline issues in the case, but in a way that is enormously dangerous. The court has repeatedly said that people who speak for free are entitled to full First Amendment protection, and we want to make sure that we're putting in front of the court not just this baker, who some members of the court may find unsympathetic, but IJ's clients, people like Steve Cooksey, our North Carolina diet blogger who was fined by the State Board of Dietetics for trying to give people advice without first having their permission. And being able to put that context in front of the court hopefully raises the importance of this doctrinal issue and persuades some of them to explicitly reject this idea, or at least to be much more careful in not adopting this idea.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the insight, Scott and Bob and Rob. We have a few questions that were submitted in advance by IJ donors, but if you have a question that you'd like to ask live, just press star on your telephone and you will be added to the queue. So just press star and then you can ask your question live to Scott, Bob, or Rob about anything that's going on in the term or what we've talked about already. So first, to turn to a couple of questions that were submitted in advance. This question is from John in California, and he wants to know, what are IJ's thoughts on the case the Supreme Court will hear this term out of New Jersey about whether Congress can bar states from authorizing sports gambling?
Well, this is kind of a fun case out of New Jersey that what it really involves is the intersection of federalism and economic liberty. And I think, you know, given that, you probably could imagine where IJ comes out. But the sort of basic fact of the case, New Jersey for years has prohibited sports gambling. Congress, the federal law, doesn't actually forbid sports gambling. Sports gambling is completely legal under federal law. But in 1992, Congress passed a law that was essentially intended to freeze in place the landscape of state law about sports gambling. So some states permit it, some states don't. And Congress basically said, you know, those of you who already forbid it, you have to keep those laws in place. Now, fast forward, New Jersey has changed their mind. They want to allow sports gambling at the Monmouth Park racetrack and also at some of the casinos in Atlantic City. And the federal government has this law, and actually all of these sports leagues, pretty much every sports league under the sun, has sued to say, you know, no, you can't do this. You have to keep forbidding this. And it's a, you know, sort of interesting case because the argument really is both, you know, New Jersey as a state can't be required to prohibit something that the federal government doesn't have a law about, that the federal government itself doesn't prohibit. And then also there's a sort of, under that, an economic liberty current of, this is a federalism restraint that really acts to encourage economic liberty by allowing states to allow things that...
It's probably worth telling people that Rob doesn't know all this off the top of his head because he is a legal computer. He worked on this issue in private practice before he decided he wanted to do good for a living instead of make millions of dollars.
And this is a case, too, that could also have implications for a lot of issues that the court is going to have to struggle with probably in the next upcoming terms, because New Jersey's argument in this case is that, listen, the federal government can't make us enforce a prohibition on sports gambling. If the federal government wants to impose that prohibition and enforce it, they can do it, but you basically can't conscript us into enforcing what you want, which is a ban on sports gambling. And of course, that has implications for issues like cities' ability to be sanctuary, so-called sanctuary cities, and whether or not the federal government can enlist state agencies to help them enforce federal law for it. So, and that's oftentimes the case with Supreme Court issues, and it's one of the reasons why the court takes them up, is that it not only just impacts the litigants in that case, but it can have an impact in looking toward future controversies before the court.
A reminder, if you have a question, just press star on your telephone and we'll add you to the queue. We had another question that came in advance from Sandra in New York, and it is for Scott. She said, Scott, you argued the Kelo case at the Supreme Court. What was that like, and how did you prepare?
Well, it's always, of course, an incredible experience to argue a big constitutional case before the Supreme Court. And it's a lot different than what many people have in mind when they think of a Supreme Court argument, where the justices are listening to your impassioned oratory very carefully, and you can go on for minutes, if not hours at a time. that's not the way it is at all. The court is let you talk for maybe a few seconds. I got out about three sentences in the opening to Kelo, and then you are peppered with questions for the remainder, and you only have 30 minutes per side to make your case, because the justices are very smart, they're very steeped in the issues, and what they're doing is they're wanting to know what are the implications of the argument that you're making. So they're pressing you on that. And they're also basically having a conversation amongst themselves, too, of trying to maybe persuade one another, and you're just kind of a foil to make points with the other justices. So your answers have to be incredibly tight, very precise, and you have to really directly answer their questions. That's what they're after, and to think through all the implications of what you're saying. The key to any good Supreme Court argument is just massive preparation and making sure that you know all of the issues. That's what we did, not only in the Kelo case, but in all of our cases before the Supreme Court, and we're prepared for basically just about any question that one of the justices wants to ask.
As an important personal follow-up of great legal importance, on the drive to the Kelo argument, did anyone sing you a song? And if so, what song was it?
Yes, that is a key point with it. And Dana,
we need to give people the inside scoop.
That's exactly right. Dana, who's a big 80s music fan, not like me.
Dana Berliner.
Dana Berliner, our senior vice president and director of litigation, sang me Eye of the Tiger to get me going before the Supreme Court.
It
worked.
All right. And we have one more time for one more question. I'll do one more that was sent in advance from Michael in Florida. And he wanted to know, how do you evaluate the success of an amicus brief?
That is a great question, and it's hard to do because in many ways the Supreme Court is a black box. You don't get to see anything about their internal deliberations, and the honest answer is sometimes you just don't know. But there are certainly signals you can get that you've been successful. The gold standard is obviously just when the court cites your brief directly in its opinion, which happened in, for example, in the Heller case, in the D.C. gun case. The majority opinion cited IJ's brief, and so we knew it had been read and had been understood. But other times, it's something more subtle, even things that just come up at oral argument. There was a case a few terms ago called Armour v. City of Indianapolis, where, kind of similar to the cake shop case, we had zeroed in on one really doctrinally dangerous portion of the opinion below, and we filed a brief just about that issue. We were the only people who filed a brief about that issue. And at oral argument, Justice Alito just brought that issue up out of the blue, and he asked the lawyer for the government, who was Paul Clement, he said, do you defend this portion of the opinion below? And Paul Clement said, no, we abandoned that. And so that also made pretty clear that we had been successful in achieving what we wanted. So it can be hard, especially when your goal is not just to kind of be on the winning side, but to achieve something narrower and more doctrinal. Sometimes you don't know, but we are always on the lookout for kind of what we can do to push the law in the proper direction.
There's actually an interesting development here. People at some shops have started running both the text of amicus briefs and then also the transcript of the oral argument and the eventual decision through plagiarism detecting software, a software that was developed to identify plagiarism in order to see if there are matches between the language and the questions, or in the opinion itself, in the language of the amicus brief, which can be a really interesting way to suss that out. And you can start to see trends in the language. We had a brief in the case Nelson versus Colorado, where it was a case that had relationship to our civil forfeiture work, and the question was, can the government essentially force you to prove your own innocence, or does the burden have to be on the government to do the opposite? And we really took a particular position on that. We had language that we wanted the court to talk about the presumption of innocence as fundamental to your constitutional rights, because that's sort of part of the due process inquiry that is relevant to our own cases. And the language that we sort of proposed and put into our amicus brief showed up in the opinion. So that's another way that you really know that you've had an impact.
Wow, that's amazing about the software. Writers cannot get away with anything. Again, they will be caught. The software will get them.
All right. With that, we are out of time. If you missed any part of our discussion, we will have an audio recording available online later this week, and I'll email a link when it's live. If you have a question or comment and didn't ask it during the conversation, you can stay on the line and leave a message, and we will respond to you personally. Thank you again to Scott, Bob, Rob, and everyone who called in for being part of our conversation. It is because of the support you provide that IJ is able to operate with this level of sophistication and secure individual liberty in the long term. Thank you again, and have a great evening.